Hi, everybody. My name's Leo, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a great joy to come and share my little sparkle with you this evening. I don't think I've ever been at a conference where that word sparkle has been used, and I think that it's so appropriate. Before I begin, I want to thank... Did I say my name's Leo and I'm an alcoholic? Thank you. I sometimes forget what I say. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to this third Florida State Convention. And many of the speakers have already met this evening, but I do want you to know that they have really gone out of their way to take care of the speakers. And as a speaker, I appreciate it. And it gives me a great deal of joy to come here. Many of you I've met before, and it's always a pleasure, because for me the whole recovery program, this fellowship, is an amazing family. It's a loving family and it's a caring family, and that makes all the difference in the world. So traveling to be here with you is really my pleasure. As Bill said to you, you probably know that by my accent that I am indeed from England. And I often say this to people because it's always interesting to say it. It was, I think, George Bernard Shaw who said that America and England are two countries divided by a common language. Because what happens is sometimes you say something and it doesn't mean the same to me. And sometimes I say something and it doesn't mean the same to you. I've been now in the United States for 8 years. And when I first came over to live in Long Beach, where I still live, I had to go to my Episcopalian church to say Mass early in the morning. And an old lady had parked her car in front of the garage where I lived. So I had to get her to move the car so that I could get to the church. Well, all this took time. But eventually I got to the church and I was late. So I stood before the congregation, rather like I'm standing before you all now, and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry that I'm late, but I had to knock up an old lady before I came to church." Congregation responded very much like you. Except I'm pleased to say there was an increase in old ladies at church the following Sunday. Every country has its famous drunks. You have Dean Martin. We had Winston Churchill. Oh, I don't know whether many of you realize that. Winston used to drink about a bottle of brandy a day. Now, I don't know whether Winston Churchill was alcoholic or not, but there are some stories told about him that I can identify with. There's a lovely story. Winston Churchill is sitting at dinner with Lady Astor. And Lady Astor turned to Winston Churchill and said, Winnie, you're drunk. And Winston Churchill, in his inimitable way, said, "Madam, you are ugly." "But I shall wake up sober in the morning." She was quick to say to him, she said, Winnie, if I was your wife, I'd put poison in your soup." "Madam, if I was your husband, I'd drink it." Now, by the way, you know, that's not, you think about it, that's not just, you know, any joke that's told about the alcoholic, and everybody, I mean, everybody has their own pet jokes and stories. But every joke that's ever revealed and told about the alcoholic says something of the disease. Think about it. In those Winston stories, you hear the denial. And you hear the manipulation. Notice how he switches the conversation from himself onto Lady Astor. And that's how it is. The denial, the manipulation, the arrogance of the alcoholic. And there are many people in this room who can identify with that. And I think that it's terribly important for us to have a sense of humor. One of the, you know, this is a spiritual program. And one of the most important spiritual gifts we can have is a sense of humor, because usually those people who have a sense of humor really are the laugh of themselves. They don't take themselves too seriously. Having a sense of humor really reminds us of the fact that we are not God. And we need not to be too stuffy. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous are really not too stuffy. That's why I feel that I can share with you this little story of a man who goes into a bar to have a drink, and he has in his top pocket a leprechaun. And he goes into the bar and he says to the barman, "Can I have two whiskies?" And he has one for himself and he gives the other one to the leprechaun. Now, at the end of the bar is a man having a drink quietly, and he sees this. And he gets really irate. He says to the man, he says, Hey, you can't bring leprechauns in here. We don't allow leprechauns in this bar. Take the leprechaun out." Now, the leprechaun is having a little drink in there. Hears this. So he jumps out of the man's pocket and runs right along the bar and gets into the man's face and goes, and then runs all the way back and jumps in the man's pocket. The man, furious at this, so he goes over there and he says, in the man's pocket, he goes over there too and he says, "Do you know what that little leprechaun's done? He's got that in my face." He says, "You know what I'm going to do?" "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to take him out of your pocket and I'm going to cut off his pee-pee." So the man turns around and says, "Don't be silly. Don't you know? Leprechauns don't have peepees." He says, "Don't they?" He says, "No." He says, "Are you sure?" He says, "A positive. Leprechauns do not have peepees." He says, "Oh, how do they go to the toilet? How do they go to the toilet to have a little pee?" He says, "Don't you know they go..." I'm sorry, the congressman missed that. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we're told, anybody who's a speaker is told, to say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And you know, there's a tremendous wisdom and simplicity in this straightforward program. This 12-step program, this program that we all love, and when we speak about it differently, but there's a sameness about it, because we owe our lives and our sanity and our recovery and everything that we hold dear today from being sober. And you know, I like to think it's a program of remembrance. I've said it before, I watched on television on the Ted Koppel show, Elie Wiese. Elie Wiese was a man who's written numerously and talked numerously about the Holocaust. And when Ted Koppel was talking to him on the television, he said to him, "Elie, you've received Nobel Prize awards for your writing of the Holocaust and you speak at universities about the Holocaust. Why do you keep talking about it 40 years or more afterwards?" And anybody said something, and when I heard it, I didn't think of the Holocaust, although of course alcoholism is a kind of Holocaust. Eliphaz said something, and immediately I thought of this program. Eliphaz said, Ted, he said, I talk about it, and I write about it, and I speak about it, because if I don't, it will all come back. And when I heard that, I thought of this program, the simplicity and yet the wisdom and profundity of this program. Whether it's a speaker meeting, whether it's a 12-step meeting, whether you're doing a 12-step call on somebody, whether you're discussing the steps, whether it's a few people talking together about their recovery, it's a program of remembrance, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And all of us speakers, Clint will be doing it tomorrow night, but all of us speakers, try to somehow or other remember again so that we won't forget. I think that so many people who relapse, or those people who are in a state of relapse, forget their roots. And this program reminds us of our roots, that we are all one drink away from a drunk. And when we hear that, we need to remember and be grateful. But as Hal talks about, an attitude of gratitude that is lived out in our lives. So I will do that. Tonight I will share my story. And although most of this took place in England, a different place, different situation, it's the same. The feelings and the emotions and the loneliness and the confusion and the insanity and craziness and humor will be the same as yours. I started to drink when I was about 15, 16 years of age in England. Nothing very extraordinary. We were sent away to a boys' school in England. They used to give us some beer before we went to sleep. And you know, it wasn't so much that I liked the taste. It wasn't so much that I got drunk in those early days. It was that I liked how I felt when I drank. And you're going to hear so many people talk about this disease of addiction as a disease of the feelings. I liked how I felt when I drank. I'm 5'7". 5'8" on a very good day. But when I drank alcohol, I felt 6'2". I felt bigger. I felt stronger. I had a stammer, a stutter, until I was about 15 years of age. I had to go to a speech therapist. And you know, what's really interesting is that I really had a lot of shame issues around that because people made fun of me. So that's where my humor comes from today. People made fun of me, and I didn't want them to make fun of me, so I made them laugh. But the incredible thing is, when I found alcohol, I got so much confidence. So much confidence. And of course, never thought that alcohol was a drug. Alcohol was like a friend. And I thought that it was going to be my friend until the day I died. And all through university, I went to a number of universities, all through universities and seminary college, I drank. And you know, there are some people who can stand at these podiums and say, right from the very first drink, they got drunk. I don't disagree with them. But it wasn't like that for me. You know, this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it's also a progressive disease. And you know, just like recovery is progressive. I was somebody who attests to the progressiveness of it. And in 1971, when I was about 23 years of age, in 1971, I was ordained a priest in the Episcopal, it's called the Anglican Church in England, and I was let loose on a parish. And you know, like you have to have excuses for why you drank, you know, because you've got to have excuses for being there and drinking like you did. Well, I had to have excuses too, because I drank in the bars. And what I said to my other priests was that the lost and the lonely, those sheep without a shepherd, they were waiting for me and I was going to bring them home. And you know where they all were? They were in the bar waiting for me. Now, you walk into a bar dressed like this and people notice you. See, there's a penguin at the end of the bar. Walking oil slicks just come in. And everybody wants to drink with a priest or to buy a priest a drink. Priests don't pay. You stand at the bar and just say, "Father, you want a drink? Double. Send Father a double." People got to like me just because I drank. They said, you're the kind of priest we like, Father Leo. You're down to earth like we're down to earth, you know. You drink like we drink. You talk like we talk, you know. You vomit like we vomit." People started to come from the bars to the church. One woman said to her husband, "George, shall we stay at home and watch Benny Hill, or shall we go to church and listen to Father Leo?" same thing's going to happen. And indeed, you know what I mean. I've always said it's true. If you're an alcoholic and a typist, there's going to be a time you're going to be drunk at your typewriter. If you're an alcoholic and you drive trucks, there's going to be a time you're drunk at your truck. If you're an alcoholic and a doctor or a dentist, you're going to be drunk in your surgery at some time. If you're an alcoholic and you're a priest, you're going to be drunk in the services. I remember once doing a funeral, drunk, followed the coffin into the hole. I tell you, it's real scary when you hear the amens coming from above. But it was an Irish funeral. So they helped me out and we went home and had some more. No, nobody ever knows about that. I tell you about that. But you know as well as I do, if you're drinking and you're in a public service, there's going to be a time people are going to get to know. Next time I got drunk, caused the problem. People got to know about it. When I talk about people, I mean the bishop. You know, a bishop's just an employer dressed in purple. Well, I'll tell you what happened so you know, because, by the way, I'm not the only one. You know, you have trouble with your employers, it's the same. What happened was I had to do baptism. And I wasn't actually drunk, you know, I was drunk mellow, you know when you're mellow. And I was doing this baptism, and the parents were there, and the grandparents were there, and the relatives and the friends were there. I mean, everybody was having a real good time at this baptism. Then I arrived. And you know what we're like when we're in that mellow state? We don't need any help. We don't need any help, you know. I came along, and I didn't really want to be there. I wanted to be back drinking, so I wasn't in the best of mood. So I said, "Come on, give me the baby. Just get going with this." So I started, and I just say, I didn't need any help. I said, "I baptize this baby in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, Daphne." I didn't ask anybody. Daphne. The mother, she let loose such a scream. She said, "Father Leo, it's a little boy." I said, "I don't care what the hell it is, it's Daphne now."
I remember her saying, she said, is there anything we can do about this? I said, no. Forever and a day, he will be called Daphne. How do you make amends to a thing like that? I know I should bring him over to California, huh? But you never guess what happened. She telephoned the bishop. Now, the next morning, of course, I've forgotten all about this. You know what we're like. We forget. We move on. Life moves on. We move on. Next morning, I get a telephone call. About 9 o'clock. Booth. Yes, that's my name. Booth. Yes. It's the bishop. I want to see you tomorrow at 9. What does he want to see me about? Why does the bishop want to see me? I'd forgotten all about this baptism. Then I thought, you know, typical alcoholic. Promotion. Bishop's going to promote me. I go and see the bishop, and the bishop, he's got a kind of piece of paper there. He's got this piece of paper. I go in and see him. He's behind the desk. He says, look at this. I've got a letter. I've got a letter. A letter. A letter. I said, good. He said, it's about you. He said, you make a habit of baptizing little boys with girls' names. What's the matter with you? Something wrong with your head? In the head? Are you loopy? You crazy? Then he said it. Now, come on. You heard this from someone. You heard it from your wife or your husband. Somebody, kids. He looked at me straight in the eyes and he said, had you been drinking? Had you been drinking? Now see if you can catch yourself in this. Who? Me? I swear on the Bible. No. But he didn't believe me. But he couldn't prove it. Ah. Yeah. He couldn't prove it. Have you ever been in that situation? When you know you're telling a lie, and they know you're telling a lie, and you know that they know you're telling a lie, but they can't prove it. But I was driving home, because you know, it's the bishop's powerful man. Powerful bishop. Oh, power. I'm driving home, and my disease, you're probably the same, my disease talked to me. Talks. Said, Leo. Leo. Lie low. The bishop's onto you. Now, here's an incredible thing. Again, I am not the only one in this conference. For 6 months, I didn't drink. Now, here's an incredible thing for some of us to remember. Because I didn't drink for 6 months, I didn't think I had a problem. Because if I could leave it alone for 6 months, I haven't got a problem. I can't be an addict, certainly can't be an alcoholic if I can leave it alone. Incredible, isn't it? 6 months, didn't have a drink. I knew I was going to drink again. The purpose of me not drinking was simply to prove who was in control. Me. And then after Christmas, we had a Christmas. I was sober, had a Christmas. Then after Christmas, we went away. Went away for a vacation. Not very far. Went away with a vacation, and I decided, I knew on that vacation I was going to drink. I went with some friends, I was going to drink, I felt everything was okay because it was 6 months late.
When I look back at it, so many significant drinking episodes, calamities, crises in my life, were also connected with good intentions. I had a very good intention during this vacation time, and that was to go and visit a 91-year-old woman and wish this woman a happy birthday. She was 91. I didn't know how long she was going to live. But I went again after drinking the night before. And when I drank, I didn't sleep very well. So I went very early in the morning, and I was dressed like this, but I went early, about 6:30 in the morning. And she was staying in a convalescent home just outside of Brighton, where I live, in Sussex, a place called Hove. And I went to see her in the convalescent home and knocked on the door. And they had these little shutters on the convalescent home like this. And they said, "Who is it?" I said, "It's Father Leo to see Elizabeth." They said, "Father Leo, it's early in the morning." I said, "I don't mind." And I went in, and Elizabeth was just waking up. She was putting in her teeth. I said, "Happy birthday, Elizabeth." She said, "Oh, little Father Leo, yes, happy birthday." So we sat and we talked for a while. Then she said, "Father Leo, it's too early to offer you a drink." I said, "Try me." Now, here's a funny thing. Again, alcoholics here can maybe identify with this. She offered me sherry. Now, I don't like sherry. I like gin. See, and I saw a bottle of gin behind the bottle of sherry. So I drank the bottle of sherry to get to the bottle of gin. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you don't understand that. But if you're an alcoholic, you do, you know. Now, I don't know, you know, because every alcoholic's different. Come on. Some alcoholics, when they get drunk, sing. Some alcoholics fight. Some alcoholics cry. I was a dancing drunk. When I got drunk, I wanted to dance. My mother used to always say, "He's drunk, he's dancing." But I knew I couldn't dance with Elizabeth. She was still putting her teeth in. So I went along the corridor because I heard the sound of a Hoover. We call them Hoovers in England, you call them vacuum cleaners. And I thought to myself, where there's a vacuum cleaner, there may be a woman. So I went strolling along, Nello Lily drunk. This woman was doing a cleaning. We call them domestic. She was doing a cleaning. She was so happy with her day. Husband had gone to work, kids had gone to school, sun was in the sky, and the birds were twittering in the trees. Little did she know, there was a drunken priest coming along the corridor. It was going to make her day. I said, "Hello." I said, "Dance with me." She said, "No." I said, "Come on, dance with me." She said, "No." Last time. I said, "Dance with me." She said, "No." So I squeezed her breast. No. No, 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 no. Not harshly. Gently. Gently. Lady here with tears in her eyes. She said to me, she said, "Don't do that." I don't know what kind of an alcoholic you were, but if anybody ever said to me, "Don't do that," I did it again. In fact, I was getting quite good at it. When the police came, I was arrested. What kind of a day is this?
Tell you, it's like the Garden of Eden up here. I was arrested. Anyway, I've got an attorney. I'm no fool. Pay the attorney. Get me off. Don't care what it costs, get me off. Well, we went before a judge and we did a deal. Explained, you know, it's an oversight, it was a mistake. It's just highly strung. Anyway, the judge, he threw it out. We got out. But, you know, same as here, as in England, the press were there. You know those hawks of truth? Well, you've heard of Jack the Ripper. Meet Leo the Squeeze. In all the newspapers. The bishop read it. He said, I'm sick of you. Oh, I'm sick of you. And this bishop needed Al-Anon. He said, you're out. Finished. I'll send you to a psychiatrist. Well, I wanted to see a psychiatrist, and I'm not against psychiatrists, you know, because, I mean, most of the time, you can't really blame psychiatrists because we never told them the truth anyway. But this psychiatrist saw me for 25, 30 minutes, so he said, after looking at me, he said, you could be schizophrenic. He said, you could be a depressive, you know. You definitely got a problem with your mother. I said, but you're not alcoholic. I said, would you put it in writing? And he did. He wrote to the bishop and said I wasn't an alcoholic. But anyway, this bishop, although he got this letter back, he knew there was something wrong with me. And he said, well, you're never going to drink again. You're never going to drink again. And he said, you're demoted. And what's interesting is, and I only share it because so many of us lost to gain. We lost to gain. It's very interesting. Now I see that loss and that pain and that suffering as a real focal point of gain for me. But at the time I didn't see that. I never went back to my house. My furniture was put in store. I never said goodbye to my parish or my people. At a stroke, I was removed. And there's a tremendous amount of sadness and there's a tremendous amount of pain with being an alcoholic. We've had fun. We've joked. But there was tremendous pain. Wet beds. Times I couldn't remember where I was. Times when I hurt the people I most loved. You know, the song says that we always hurt the one we love. For a long time when I came into this parish, I really said that I wasn't violent, except verbally. That was not true. As an alcoholic, as a priest alcoholic, I was very violent, not just verbally. To my parents, to those people who loved me. I could lash out and be not only cruel verbally, but also physically. I need to remember that today. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. I was changing. I was changing. And instead of creating, I was destroying. Instead of creating, I was destroying. And the one thing for me is terrible loneliness. And terrible fear. I talk about the kind of fear that makes your breath smell. I had the kind of fear that upset my stomach so. Some of the hangovers, very painful.
always acting afterwards. Saying the mass, doing the sermon, trying to meet people, and inside falling apart, but outside trying to hold it together. And then I was removed from my parish and sent as an assistant. I'd love to be able to tell you that I did not drink again. But that was not true. I was not sober. I was dry. Because the bishop had said, and for some of you it may have been because of your wife or your husband or your family or your job, for me, because the bishop had said, and he really meant it when he said, if you should ever drink again, he says, you will be thrown out. And because of that, I stopped drinking for 6 months. I did not go to meetings. He was not informed enough to understand about meetings. This was a long time ago now, 10 years ago now. And AA is really not as strong in England as it is over here. It is getting stronger, but it is nowhere near as strong. And so I was never sent to AA. And, you know, it's very interesting, this word dryness, you know, because sobriety is not the same as dryness. Dryness is when it's like a leaf, you know, like a dry leaf. And any pressure that you put on a dry leaf, snap. I was like that. I was angry, I was resentful. Because I was dry. Sobriety is not the same. Sobriety is not a dry leaf. Sobriety is a supple leaf. In sobriety, we learn to bend, go with the flow. But when you're dry, you're stiff and you're rigid, and you're very angry, and you bury it. Sometimes people are dry at even meetings and conferences. They're not actually working the steps. They've not really experienced that acceptance. Not just the admittance, but the acceptance of knowing when you say, my name's Leo, I'm an alcoholic, you don't just say it, you feel it. You feel it. Well, I was not sober, I was dry. And I've often said to people, because everybody worries, how did you drink again? The relapse, you know. After 6 months, I got a telephone call and I was invited to a very ordinary party. And I thought that at this ordinary party that, you know, I'd just do what I've always done, and that was drink 7-Up. Gosh, I was fizzed out on 7-Up, let me tell you. But I was stood there drinking this 7-Up, and, you know, coincidence. We've all heard it 1,000 times. Coincidence is God working a miracle anonymously. But this coincidence was that there was a woman from the parish at the party that I knew years ago. And she said something very interesting, connected with dryness. She said, Father Leo, I knew you when you drank, and I see you now. And you know there's a big difference. Now you seem so bored. Dry people are very bored. Not only are they bored, but they're very boring. Why are they bored and why are they boring? Because they're not doing what they want to do. What is it they want to do? Drink. That woman had put a finger right on the button. Pop! She got me all right. And then she followed up and she said it, and you've heard it 1,000 times. She said, why don't you just have a drink? Just one. Well, here's an incredible thing. I actually had 2. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Some of you may have thought, oh, once he had that one, gosh, he would have had 22. 2. It is cunning, it is baffling, and it is powerful. We'll never really understand it. We'll never really understand. And I went home after 2. But again, a strange thing, inconsequential, many of you may think. I left my watch in the restroom. And the next morning when I woke up, the watch wasn't on my wrist. So I telephoned the barman where the party had been. I said, George, did you find a watch? He said, I found a watch in the restroom. I said, it's mine. He said, I'll keep it for you. I said, okay. And then I said, George, whilst I'm on the telephone, I had two drinks last night. I'm scared. Why are you scared? He said, why are you scared? I said, because if the bishop finds out, I'm not supposed to have any. The bishop doesn't want me to drink. George, the bishop thinks I'm an alcoholic. He says to me, he says, well, Leo, you can't be an alcoholic. I said, why? Why can't? He said, because you had two. You had two drinks and you went home. An alcoholic couldn't have two drinks and go home. Alcoholics, once they start to drink, they drink, 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 drink. I tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. It's changing because of education today. But ignorance is our biggest enemy. You can't be an alcoholic if you drink in the, unless you drink in the morning. You can't be an alcoholic if you only drink beer. If you're an alcoholic, you drink all day and every day. That's not true. For most of us, that's simply not true. We didn't drink all day and every day. Some days we did. Many days we didn't. Many of us in this room held our jobs till the very end. Some never had a DUI. It's incredible. It is a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease. It is not obvious. Very cunning. And this George was telling me something that my sick head wanted to hear. I was not an alcoholic because on that occasion I had two drinks and I went home. I said, George, are you sure that I'm not an alcoholic? He said his immortal words. He said, Father Leo, if you're an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. And he is. So anyway, no more. I went to get the watch. I go into the watch early in the morning in England in this pub, this bar pub. 10 o'clock, 10:30. I said, hello, George. He says, here's your watch, Father Leo. I said, thank you so much. And then he followed it up. He says, have one for the road. Hey, last night, I had two. Same bar. Same barman. It could have been the same glass. It could have been the same bottle of gin. That morning, 10:30, when I took that drink, the lion was disturbed. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. We never understand it. But you know what I mean. That morning, when I took that drink, I knew I wanted more. I knew that 2, or even 22, would not be enough. And I drank some drinks there, and then I went to another bar and drank some drinks, and then I went to another bar and drank some drinks, and then I took off my collar and I drank, and by 3 o'clock in the afternoon I was drunk as a skunk. And my car never made it home. I drove my car, and my car, on a summer's day in July, I kept my birthday on the 4th of July, my car hit a tree and hit a lamppost, and it shot up in the air. I was just a few blocks from home. The car hit the tree, hit the lamppost, shot up in the air. Two old ladies saw it and said, look, there goes Father Leo. That's how he travels now. But I didn't stay up there. I came down, crash, bang, wallop, got out. Cut my leg, cut my face. Sat at the side of the road, sat at the side of the road. I knew the drill. I'd done it before. You wait for the police and the ambulance. Said that this day I had a moment. You know, it's an incredible thing. We hear a lot about intervention. There are many interventions. It's not just an intervention that is stylized with a family.
There's a moment, granted, I believe, by God, that we have to grab. But there's a moment when we see ourselves. I mean, really see ourselves. Well, I was sitting there at the side of the road, and I was bleeding, and I was hurt, and I felt terrible. And I was granted one of these special, precious moments. Out of myself. It was as if I stepped out of myself. It was as if I stepped out of myself and I saw myself. And I saw myself bleeding and I saw myself hurt. And I didn't like what I saw. Very simple, you know. Very simple, you know. I didn't like what I saw, and I didn't like what I was becoming. You don't have to use profound language. I didn't like me. But I was given this special moment, and incidentally, I believe that we've been given many, many moments. But this time, that moment, I've grabbed it, and I've held on to it. And there's rarely a day, rarely a day, that I don't remember it. That was my intervention. It was to be followed up by others with the bishop and my family, but that was the crucial intervention that talks about my unmanageability and my powerlessness. I saw me. See, the big thing for me is, this is not the bishop now talking about the car crash, all my parents, all my friends. I saw me. For some of you, it may not have been a car crash. For some of you, it may have been when your wife said she's going to leave. Or your husband. For some of you, it may have been your kids crying, and they're crying because of you. There's 1,001 ways when you get to see you. I made a telephone call, and I called up the bishop, and it's incredible. I thought the bishop was going to bawl me out and tell me I was finished. He's now become a very good friend of mine. He said, you know, Leo, when you called from that car accident, there was something different in your voice. He used a word that we use. Of course, he did not know it was a word we used. He said it was as if you'd surrendered. Well, I don't believe I'd surrendered then. But I believe that I was in the process of surrendering. How did you get here? Pain. How did you get here? Pain. Every one of us, all of our stories, it climaxes, the crisis comes, it's the pivot of our stories. And from that moment, from that day, I've never had another drink. I went into treatment. And when I was in treatment, I went to AA. And when I went to AA, I heard my story from other people, a little Jewish woman who befriended me, a guy with many years on the program. I immediately took to it. I was told about a God as I can understand him, and that made a lot of sense to me, because really, when I think about it, there were many things that I used. I used alcohol, sure. I also used people, sure. And I also used God and my faith, sure. And this program has a way of making the most dishonest honest, because you're simply not comfortable being the way you are. And I was introduced to a loving, caring family that seemed to include everybody, suggested steps only. And whereas being in churches and I knew congregations that had pointed the finger at people, in this fellowship, in this program, it seemed as though people were willing to love you in spite of yourself. And it was all kinds of people. All kinds of people from all different backgrounds, all different religions, based on the steps that we chose to take. And I believe that this is a program of responsibility. Those of us who grow in this program grow because we take responsibility for our lives. We are not believing in a God. who just takes care of us without us also taking care of ourselves. Those steps are steps that we take. Those steps are steps that if we don't choose to take them, they'll never be taken. I know there are people who talk about turning your life over. And I understand turning your life over rather like you turn your life in a new direction. I don't believe it's a case of handing your life over. And I've said this 1,000 times. If God has created us, why are we handing it back? He created us in freedom. He gave us life. We don't hand it back. We turn our lives in a new direction. And we start taking responsibility for our lives. That's why we make amends. And that's why we start to look at ourselves honestly. And that's how we start to try to heal from within. I've often said it, and I believe it's true, and I learned it in this program. Whatever God you believe in is the God that you will reflect in your life. You believe in a God of truth, then you need to start being truthful. You believe in a God of change, then you start to change. You believe in a God of forgiveness, then practice forgiveness in your life. This is an incredible program. When I first went to college and university, I probably truly believed that the world would be taken back to God through religion. Now I don't believe that. What I believe is something I think many of you will understand. I believe something very incredible happened when one alcoholic went to meet another suffering alcoholic. When Bill met Bob, an incredible gift was given to this world. Through sharing, through honesty, through people actually being vulnerable and sharing their vulnerability and suffering, a special healing came into the world. Look how we've grown. Look how we've grown. Not just grown as alcoholics, but there are so many people today taking this spiritual program and using it in their lives. Adult children of alcoholics, people with eating disorders, people with gambling problems, people with sex problems, Al-Anons, codependents. There are so many people with this problem. Addiction, compulsion, obsession, that are getting help. Women who love too much. Men who love too much being helped by the steps of this program. Is there anybody who isn't included? You go to foreign countries and you hear the same steps and the same program, touching people with different religions, different cultures, different skin. So I suggest, perhaps a dream, that on the back of one alcoholic talking to a suffering alcoholic, the world will be taken back to God. We've only just begun. I know in my part of Los Angeles, there are more people going to 12-step meetings on any one day, including Sundays, than are ever attending the churches. People find a meaning here. People find God here, and they don't feel judged, and they don't feel controlled. Some time ago, when I was in Atlanta some years ago, speaking at an AA convention, not unlike this, I spoke about this moment. I spoke about this car crash. And a young man came over to me afterwards and got me and shook me by the hand. He said, "Father Leo," he said, "you know that car crash?" He said, "you know that car crash when you got to see yourself?" I said, "yes." He said, "do you think you have to have a car crash to see yourself?" I said, "no." He said, "I'll tell you why." He said, "I'll tell you why, because you were talking about a car crash." He said, "but," he said, "for me,
I had a similar experience, but it wasn't a car crash. It came through a song. I said, a song? He said, on the radio. He said, on the radio, I heard a song. Oh, I've heard that song, he said, 1,000 times before, but this time I really heard it. I said, I'm sure that's true, because God can work through a car crash or a song, or God can work through people sharing with one another. If it's God's world, there's no limits to where God can be found. I said, but tell me about this song that touched you so. He said, well, I was hurting for alcohol and I was hurting for cocaine. And I know I needed to go out and get some. And I was just getting ready to go out and I had a soul for that stuff, anything for that stuff. And on the radio, I heard the song. And as I said to you, I'd heard this song 1,000 times, but this time, I really heard it. And just like you were brought to your knees by a car crash, I was brought to my knees by this song. I said, what were the words of the song? Because I'll share it at meetings. And who knows, it may touch somebody's life and make God real to them. He says, the words of the song are reminiscent, and I wanted to share it with you because it was originally sung by an English group, the Beatles, and it has since been made very famous by Tina Turner. The words of the song are these. When I was a young man, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. But now those days have gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find I've changed my mind and I've opened up the door. So help me. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being around. Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please, help me? And he said, Father Leo, I found in this program, help. I says, I know, David, because 11 years ago, I found help too. And all of you are at this convention, in your own ways, are finding that help that makes your life more meaningful today. All I can promise you, and I end with this, all I can promise you in this program are the things that I've experienced. In this 12-step program, we will live again. In this program, we will learn to love again. And perhaps the most important gift of all, in this program, we will be able to laugh again. Thank you very much indeed for listening.